Good morning to each one. I greet you this morning in our Savior's precious name. It's good to be together with you, worshiping together. Absence makes the heart grow fonder. We haven't been together for a while, so it's great to be together. Happy Valentine's Day, but I don't have a Valentine's message this morning. The Lord led me to a message. I wasn't sure when he wanted me to share it, and I decided to share it this morning. The title is, The Earth is the Lord's. We just came through an election season that was very tumultuous. I just wonder how many of us were anxious about it. I've talked to enough people, I'm pretty sure it was a lot of anxiety among our people, what was going to happen this election. And I asked the question, why is that? Why were we as Christian people so concerned about it? Well, I understand in a large part why we were. We live in a great nation. We as people enjoy things that most of the world just dreams about. And it's our lives every day. We live in a great nation. And some of the ideas that are floated around, we know are going to destroy our nation. So that's why we're anxious about it. But I was reading in Isaiah recently. And as I studied the prophecy that I was reading, and I looked at history, it just inspired me of who God is and how he controls our world. And I'd like to share that with you this morning. I'd invite you to open your Bibles to Isaiah 44. The passage that I was inspired with was Isaiah, the last part of Isaiah 44 into Isaiah 45 and 46. And I would urge you to go home and read it and study it, especially as you think about what I bring out this morning that God prophesied, as well as what came true and how God brought it about. Go home and read this passage and study it, and I think it'll inspire you of who God is. See, the earth is the Lord's. That is an absolute fact. He's God of the universe, and the earth is his, and he controls the earth. I want to read the last part of Isaiah 44, and then what I'm going to do, I'm going to read this kind of as a foundation for the message. Then I want to pick out passages in the other two chapters to look at. Isaiah 44, I'm going to start reading verse 24. Thus saith the Lord, thy Redeemer, and he that formed thee from the womb, I am the Lord that maketh all things, that stretcheth forth the heavens alone, that spreadeth abroad the earth by myself, that frustrateth the tokens of the liars, and maketh diviners mad, that turneth wise men backward, and maketh their knowledge foolish, that confirmeth the word of his servant, that confirmeth the word of his servant and performeth the counsel of his messengers, that saith to Jerusalem, thou shalt be inhabited, and to the cities of Judah, ye shall be built, and I will raise up the decayed places thereof, that saith to the deep, be dry, and I will dry up thy rivers, that saith of Cyrus, he is my shepherd, and shall perform all my pleasure, even saying to Jerusalem, thou shalt be built, and to the temple, thy foundation shall be laid. I'll give you just a little bit of insight of where we're going. That last verse, 28, is an amazing verse. Was Cyrus born yet? Was his grandfather born yet? This was almost 150 years before Cyrus was born. And God said, Cyrus is going to rebuild Jerusalem. Was Jerusalem sent into captivity yet? Was it destroyed? And the answer is no. This was before they ever went into captivity. You see, the earth is the Lord's. God is orchestrating things to come to pass because the earth is his, and he has a plan for the earth. I want to look, first of all, at the fact that God is the God of the universe. If you read Psalm 45 and 46 when you get home, you're going to find eight times that God says, I am the Lord and there's no other, or something to that effect. He is making a statement that he is almighty, that his plans come to be, and no one can foil his plans. That's the statements he's making. Time and again, as he makes that statement, he's prophesying what's going to come to be. And he says, this is going to happen. I'm the Lord. And there's no other. He is declaring his sovereignty and his almightiness as being God. The earth is the Lord's. Let me just show you just a few of them. Chapter 45, verse 5, the first part of the verse says, I'm the Lord. There's none else. There's no God beside me. Verse 6, the last part of the verse. I am the Lord. There's none else. Verse 18, the last part of the verse. I am the Lord. There's none else. Verse 22, the last part of the verse. For I am God, and there is none else. I had to think about what God was saying. And if I have it correctly, he is saying, I am the only force in this world that matters. But how do I come to grasp with the fact that Satan has tremendous power in this world? And I had to think about that a little bit. I had to contemplate, what is God saying? But you see, even when we go back to the book of Job, Satan wanted to tempt Job and test Job. And he had to go to God, and God gave him the freedom in this area, but he set a hedge around and said, no further. And that's all Satan could do. Then Satan went back to God. He wanted the hedge, the boundary changed. God changed the boundary, but he still had a boundary. You see, Satan wields tremendous power in our universe, but it's only under God's authority. God is saying, I am God, and there's none other. When we have tests and temptations in our life, do we understand that God is still in control of what's happening? It's not like things that went out of his control. He's still ruling and reigning. And are we willing to submit to what he has for our lives? 1 Corinthians 10:13 was a verse I thought as well about this. It says, there's no temptation taking you, but such is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you be tempted above that you're able, but will with the temptation also make a way to escape that ye may be able to bear it. God is God, and there's none other. There's no one else in our lives, as well as even in wicked people in our world. He is still God. This passage in Isaiah 44 to 46 was a message God was sending the children of Israel because of their wickedness. The northern kingdom of Judah had already went into captivity, but the northern kingdom of Israel went into captivity. The southern kingdom of Judah had not. But the southern kingdom of Judah was still tremendously wicked, even though they saw what happened to the northern kingdom. God was saying, I've sent my prophets to you time and again. You've gotten the message, but you're not hearing. You're not obeying. You're still being wicked. And God's message to them was, there's going to be judgment because he's God. Because he rules the world, and he brings judgment on those who refuse to listen to what he has for them. Actually, this thought of him being God is brought out as well here in the verses we read in Isaiah 44. He's saying, I'm creator. I'm the one that created all this. I'm the one that frustrates the words of the false prophets. They say things, and I don't let it come to be. But then my prophets say things, and I make it happen. And then he talks about Cyrus and what he's going to do with him. And I had to study that one. That one intrigued me as I studied it. But I want us to notice, as we look at this, what God prophesies about Cyrus, that God is orchestrating this world. And he's orchestrating the rulers of this world for his glory and for the purpose he has in this world. Let's go to Isaiah 45. I want to read, starting at verse 1. Now remember, as we read this, Cyrus was not born yet. 144 years before he was born, God said this is what's going to happen. The Persian Empire was not in existence when God said these words. Let's start reading verse 1. Thus saith the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I've holden, to subdue nations before him, and I will loose the loins of kings, to open before him the two-leaved gates, and the gates shall not be shut. I will go before thee and make the crooked places straight. I will break in pieces the gates of brass and cut in sunder the bars of iron. And I will give thee the treasures of darkness and hidden riches of secret places, that thou mayest know that I, the Lord, which call thee by thy name, am the God of Israel. For Jacob, my servant's sake, and Israel, mine elect, I have even called thee by thy name. I have surnamed thee, though thou hast not known me. I am the Lord, and there is none else. There is no God beside me. I girded thee, though thou hast not known me, that they may know from the rising of the sun and from the west that there is none beside me. I am the Lord, and there is none else. All these verses, he's talking about Cyrus. What he's going to do with Cyrus. But remember, Cyrus wasn't born. So I had to go back and study history. I wanted to see what happened. It was so interesting. God said in these verses, he's going to break the bars of the gates. He's going to level the mountains. He's going to give this man, Cyrus, all the hidden treasures. He's going to make him a great man. What actually happened? Cyrus started the Persian Empire, and the Persian Empire became the greatest empire the world had known at that time. Its territory went from Egypt to India. If you look on a map, it's a huge territory. God had said, I'm going to raise this man up and give him all this. Why? Why did he say he was going to do that? Now, let's look at verses 11 to 13. Well, let me back up. Verse 4 says he's going to do it for Jacob, for his servant's sake. I want to look at verses 11 to 13. Thus saith the Lord, the Holy One of Israel, and his Maker, ask me of things to come concerning my sons and concerning the work of my hands, command ye me. I've made the earth and created man upon it. I, even my hands, have stretched out the heavens, and all their hosts have I commanded. I have raised him, which is talking about Cyrus, I've raised him up in righteousness, and I will direct all his ways. He shall build my city. He shall let go my captives, not for price nor reward, saith the Lord of hosts. Now, I don't want us to get us confused. In verse 13, he says, I've raised him up in righteousness. Cyrus was a wicked man. God was not saying Cyrus is going to be a godly man. You notice in verse 4 and verse 5, which we read, he said, you haven't known me. Cyrus wasn't a godly man. God didn't raise this man up because he was a godly man and so God was blessing him. He took a wicked man, raised him up as this king or this ruler over this huge empire for one purpose, and that was to let his captives go home. You notice in verse 13, he said, he's going to let my captives go, but not for price nor reward. How did God get that accomplished? I was just intrigued when I studied history to see what happened. Up until the time of Cyrus, every ruler that had ruled before then, when they conquered a nation, they made the people slaves. And if you think about it, you think of what that did to his kingdom. He had people who were loyal to him. He brought these slaves back. These were slaves now of these people. And they became that much more loyal to him because their life became easier. These slaves came back. They were the woodcutters, the water haulers. They did the dirty work for these people. They had plenty of slaves. Every ruler till Cyrus did that. Till Cyrus. God put within this man a heart that he did something different. When he captured other nations, he would treat the people with respect. He would put a governing body in place that was loyal to him, but he would make sure in that governing body there were people that understood the customs of the land, the traditions. And they had firm orders to make sure they governed in a way that was good for the good of those people. And every nation that he conquered then became loyal to him. It worked tremendously for him. But he was the first one that ever did it. So it makes perfect sense. We understand why he had the heart to let the Jewish people go home. No conqueror ever did that. No conqueror ever let slaves go free. But Cyrus did. Do you see how God works, even in the rulers of this world, to get his purpose accomplished? God said 100 years or more before it ever happened, before Israel even went into captivity, that the walls would be destroyed, the temple would be destroyed, but Cyrus would rebuild it, and he did. Do you see the Almighty God that we serve? I had to think then as I studied this, does God still work this way today? I want us to go to two passages in Daniel. If you will, turn to Daniel chapter 2. I want to go to two passages in Daniel because even in the book of Daniel, God was saying, I rule this world. And I believe God still rules the world today. I don't think God has changed in how he's operating in our world today. Here in Daniel 2, you remember the story. King Nebuchadnezzar had a dream. And his dream troubled him greatly. He called together his wise men, and he said, tell me my dream and give me the interpretation. And they said, well, King, you tell us the dream. We'll give you the interpretation. And he said, no, I've decided you have to tell me the dream and then tell me the interpretation. And they said, well, no king in his right mind ever told wise men to tell him the dream. We need to know the dream. And King Nebuchadnezzar got upset and he ordered their execution. Well, when the word got out, of course, Daniel and his friends were going to be executed as well because they were part of the wise men of Babylon. And so Daniel and his friends prayed and sought God that he would reveal the dream to him and the interpretation. Look at verses 20 and 21. This is what Daniel said after he woke up and realized what the dream was and what the interpretation was. Listen to what he says. Daniel answered and said, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his, and he changeth the times and the seasons. He removeth kings and setteth up kings. He giveth wisdom unto the wise and knowledge to them that know understanding. Daniel realized the dream and the interpretation. He realized who God was and how he operates. And he said, he removeth kings and he setteth up kings. Now, when you look at the dream, the interpretation, God was revealing to Nebuchadnezzar the history of the world and what was going to happen from then to the coming of Jesus Christ. And this is what happened. The Babylonian kingdom under Nebuchadnezzar reigned until the time of Cyrus and the Persian Empire. Then they were in power for a while. Then the Greek Empire overtook them under Alexander the Great. Then the Roman Empire. They were in power when Jesus Christ came. And the last kingdom is the kingdom of Jesus Christ, which is going to rule the world. Daniel saw this. He realized God had a plan for the next 1,500 years. God's plan worked if you look at history. Go to Daniel chapter 4. Nebuchadnezzar had another dream. This was the dream of the great tree that God said to cut down, but leave the roots, or leave the stump and the roots. Notice verse 17. This is the words of Nebuchadnezzar. The watcher, he calls him in the dream, the watcher had told Nebuchadnezzar something. This is what he says. Verse 17, this matter is by the decree of the watchers and the demand by the word of the holy ones to the intent that the living may know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men and giveth it to whomsoever he will and setteth up over it the basest of men or the lowest of men. We could even say the dumbest of men. God doesn't necessarily set the greatest men as rulers of a nation. God sets up whoever he will. Later, as Daniel gave the king the interpretation of the dream, he said this in verse 24 and 25. "This is the interpretation, O king, and this is the decree of the Most High, which has come unto my lord the king, that they shall drive thee from men. Thy dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and they shall make thee to eat grass as oxen. And they shall wet thee with the dew of heaven, and 7 times or 7 years shall pass over thee, till thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will." And this prophecy came true exactly as Daniel said for King Nebuchadnezzar. God is the ruler of this universe. The earth is his. What transpires in this earth is all going to a culmination of God's will. Because God sets up who he will and he puts down who he will. I have no question that God orchestrated events in America so that Donald Trump was the 45th president and that Joe Biden was the 46th. And he knows who's going to be the 47th for as long as America is in existence. That is God. That is our God. He rules this earth. Go back to Isaiah 46, if you will. I'm going to read verses 8 to 10 of Isaiah 46, and I'm going to read this in the New King James Version. Remember this, Isaiah 46, verse 8. "Remember this and show yourselves men. Recall to mind, O you transgressors. Remember the former things of old, for I am God and there's no other. I am God and there's none like me. Declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will do my pleasure." Do you get that last verse that we've read, verse 10? God is declaring, there are things that have not come to be, but they will, because I'm God. And I control this earth and what happens on this earth. Couldn't help but think of the words of Solomon in Proverbs 21, verse 1. He says this, "The king's heart is in the hand of the Lord. Like the rivers of water, he turns it wherever he wishes." God works in the hearts of the rulers of this world to bring about his will, however he intends it to be. Okay, another aspect of God that I want to notice from these passages, if you will, turn to Isaiah 45, and that is the aspect that God is God, and we cannot question him. I want to read Isaiah 45, starting verse 9. I want to read from the New King James again. Isaiah 45, verse 9. "Woe to him who strives with his maker. Let the potsherd strive with the potsherds of the earth. Shall the clay say to him who forms it, what are you making? Or shall your handiwork say he has no hands? Woe to him who says to his father, what are you begetting? Or to the woman, what have you brought forth? Thus saith the Lord, the Holy One of Israel and his maker, ask me of things to come concerning my sons, and concerning the work of my hands, you command me. I have made the earth and created man on it. My hands stretch out the heavens, and all their host I have commanded. I have raised him up in righteousness," again speaking of Cyrus, "I will direct all his ways. He shall build my city and let my exiles go free, not for price nor reward, says the Lord of hosts." Again, God was saying, you may not understand what I'm doing, but I have a purpose. The children of Israel were not going to appreciate what God was doing. God was going to punish them for 70 years for their sin. But he says, you don't have a right to question me because I'm God. This is my doing. This is what I'm doing. It's my will. I had to think again about what transpired then. God raised up Cyrus, who was a wicked man. The Persian Empire was not a godly nation. God raised them up, used them for the purpose he had decided, and then he brought judgment on them, just as he brought judgment on the Babylonian Empire. He had raised up Nebuchadnezzar, but yet he brought judgment on them. Isaiah 47 actually decrees judgment on Babylon because Babylon had took the children of Israel, and instead of treating them as God wanted to treat them, they oppressed them. And so God brought judgment on the kingdom of Babylon, and then they were done away with. Then he brought judgment on the Persian Empire because of their wickedness, and another empire came into being. And I had to ponder that a while, and I had to think about the United States. You see, we live in a nation that has been second to none in our world. We live lives that most of the world just dreams of living. That's our lives. It's been ever since I was born, for all of you, the same way. Does that mean this is going to go forever? Is God just going to let the United States be the wicked nation it is forever? And I look at the United States and I seriously doubt it. I don't think God will let that happen. God has always brought judgment on nations that are wicked. I don't know what's going to happen, but I have to ask myself, did God allow the United States to be the nation it is because he had a purpose in the world for the United States to fulfill? I think that's probably the case. Will God bring judgment? I don't know. But I see a very real possibility he will. My challenge to us as Christian people is, will we be faithful if God decides he's going to bring judgment on America? Will we be faithful? Or will we think we have to compromise to keep this great nation that we've enjoyed for all these years? That's the question we have to ask. What will we do as a nation? I had to think back through history again. You see, there were Mennonites in Germany that pledged their allegiance to a man who they said they were convinced was going to keep the values that Germany was intended to have, Christian values. So they pledged their support to him. And he wrote a letter back to them thanking them for their support. That letter is preserved in history. I don't think he wrote a letter to everybody that supported him, but it was pretty significant these Mennonites supported him, and they supported a monster. It was Adolf Hitler. I ask you, is that really what God wants us doing? Does God want us getting involved in the kingdoms of this world when we aren't able to see God's will and God's plan for the future? But I am completely confident God has a plan for the future of America and the future of other nations. That same thing happened in Russia in the 1900s. The early part of the 1900s, the Mennonites in Russia had become wealthy beyond imagination. They had a community that was basically a nation of itself. And they were sure this utopia was going to last forever, but it didn't. In the early 1900s, there was chaos in Russia. Different administrations came into being. Because of that chaos, anarchy ruled for a while. And I want to tell you, brothers and sisters, a bad government is better than anarchy. And when that anarchy ruled, there were raiders that came through these communities and robbed and plundered and raped. And it happened over and over again. The young people of those communities got tired of it, the Mennonite communities, and they said, we're going to start our own police force, and they did. And the older ones in the community said, we can't do this. This isn't scriptural. But they didn't take a stand against it, and it continued. Some years later, the German army came in, and the Mennonites thought, this is the answer. This is the government that we need so this anarchy is not ruling. And they embraced the German army that came in. The German army actually helped to arm them and helped to train them to protect their communities. And they bought right into it because they'd already taken up arms. But the Russian army was watching. And when the Russian army drove the Germans out of those areas, they were merciless to these people. They executed every person that had taken up arms until they were all done and said over half the men of that community disappeared either through execution, starvation, or being worked to death in labor camps. Again, I ask, brothers and sisters, are we willing to place our commitment in the great God who says the earth is mine and I'm going to rule this earth? No, everything that comes into our existence may not be nice. It may be hard, actually. But are we willing to say, I will not compromise, I'm going to serve God, whatever he brings into my life? I want us to notice one other thing. Let's go back to Isaiah 47, and I'm going to look at verse 7. Excuse me, Isaiah 45. I want to look at verse 7. This was a verse I struggled with as I looked at this passage because it brought up something that I had never noticed that God says. Isaiah 45, verse 7, he says this, I form the light and create darkness. I make peace and create evil. I, the Lord, do all these things. I said, does God create evil? He says he does here. Now, the word is disaster. That's what the word is. But, you know, in my mind, and I've actually taught this, that, you know, were it not for the fall of man, there wouldn't be evil in the world. There wouldn't be these disasters. And I really think that's true. But within the framework of the fallen mankind and humanity, God says, I bring disaster. And I had to grapple with that. Does God really do that? But God says he does. So my question is, will we commit ourselves and accept the fact that God is the God of the earth? What happens on this earth is not out of his realm of control. There are things he allows we won't appreciate, we won't want to accept. But will we commit ourselves to the God of this earth, whatever he brings into our lives, and never compromise? So in closing, I'd like to give us six things that I think we need to learn from this passage in Isaiah. One is God is almighty. He controls the world, and he brings to pass his will in this world. Number two, God sets in place the leaders of the nations for his glory. Number three, God allows wicked men to rule in our world to bring about his will for the earth. Number four, Christians should never lose focus of the biblical principle that we're a part of the heavenly kingdom, not the earthly kingdoms. Number five, Christians should never think they need to be involved in this world's political system to bring change about in our world. This is God's realm of work, not ours. And number six, Christians should never compromise biblical principles ever. Shall we have a song?